little that way.
Uh-huh. House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Monday, May 8th, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 144A. Call Senator Farioli, Senator Roblin,
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 144A removes the current exception which has allowed individuals to keep archaeological objects they unintentionally discover on public lands. It also requires designated Indian tribes to be notified when such items are seized. Finally, SB 144A requires the district attorney to notify the attorney general if the district attorney declines to prosecute in cases involving the unlawful excavation, removal, or selling of archaeological objects, and allows the attorney general to prosecute. However, notification would not be required if the case was declined for insufficient admissible evidence. There is a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and no amendments.
Okay, thank you. Senator, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Ted Farioli, District 30. All are part of 11 counties, 34,000 square miles. Some of it, well, all of it actually in Indian country. Some of it is reservation land. It is all ceded land. I'm here today to support Senate Bill 144. Senate Bill 144, unfortunately, is driven by the need to change the statute to make clear to people that artifacts that are collected, some of them are so culturally significant that they should never be considered collectible. They belong to the heritage of Native American peoples. Many of these objects, like the picture that you just saw circulated, are funerary objects. They are accorded a special significance in the cultural life of Native American people. We've had cases where these artifacts have been collected intentionally, where Oregon State Police officers have done the investigations, made the arrest, made the case, delivered the case to the prosecutor. And because of the prosecutor's assessment of ambiguity in the law, the cases were never filed, or if they were filed, they were dismissed, and the artifact returned to the collector. Let me repeat that. And the culturally significant artifact returned to the collector. So the bill that you have before you is a solution that's been negotiated between law enforcement and prosecutors and proponents. And what it does is clarifies the fact that if, for whatever reason, a case is made and the decision by the prosecutor is not to prosecute, they have to write a little report indicating why they made the decision not to prosecute, share that with the tribal members, and also with the attorney general. The attorney general would then have the option on reviewing the evidence to make the decision to prosecute the case. So it is another set of eyes to review whether or not the offense against the tribe's cultural heritage is significant enough to warrant prosecution, either at the state level or initially at the county level. So, colleagues, it's just one of those situations. We don't want to question the assessment that there's ambiguity in the law. We'll just fix it and remove the ambiguity, and in the neighborhood, while we're there, we'll add another pair of eyes and another authority to prosecute if local decision making is such that it does not result in a prosecution or a return of these culturally significant artifacts to the appropriate tribe. I love the bill.
And I think that
if you think about it, you will realize that there's a good purpose to the bill.
Thank you, Senator Roblin. Please.
Senator Arne Roblin, House District 5, Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay and over into Sheridan Falls City. Four of the nine federally recognized tribes are in my district. This is an important cultural issue that I think we should have taken care of a long time ago. In fact, I think a lot of people thought it was taken care of. But as the artifact was passed around, you saw that Senator Farioli gave you, that was determined to be an arrowhead. Now, I would love to know what Native American was strong enough to put that in a bow and fire it with what kind of shaft it was going to have to hold it. But clearly it was an edged instrument, a knife. It could have been buried with that person because it was such a special piece of an artifact. But it definitely was not an arrowhead, and it should never have been given back to the collector, in my opinion. We have people who have significantly different ideas about Native American culture and other things, and there are a lot of collectors out there. We had a really big problem in Senator Farioli's district when the drought was happening and lake beds were going back and things were exposed, and people thought that was the time then to go out and pick up those artifacts. We don't want that to ever happen again. We think that it was the wrong thing then, it's the wrong thing now, and this bill allows us to put in our statutes and give that second set of eyes from the Justice Department to make determinations and then to follow through in things that are clearly not appropriate. We have heard of and we know that it happens, that there are people who own a number of skulls and other things that they have found, and then sometimes they want to figure out what they should do with something they shouldn't have, and they'll figure out ways to get it to the appropriate places. But the reality is they shouldn't have it in the first place. We need to make sure that those kind of things don't happen. We have the Commission on Indian Services that we set up as a standing committee in the state. It's the only one like it. Senator Farioli and I both serve on that committee, and we find it really important to have real conversations with our tribes to move forward in recognizing their cultural history, as well as the fact that we know they've been in this state for as long as 10,000 years, probably longer. And we don't want people picking up things and then not depositing them in the right place. We have an organization in the commission to make sure they get back to the right places with the information of where it was found and so on. They can easily, well, not necessarily easily, because a lot of our tribes moved around a lot, but they can get it back to the appropriate tribe and help us restore some of the stuff to the tribe. So I urge your support.
Thank you. Mr. Pitt, please.
Yeah. Louis Pitt, Jr., Yellen Schwicht. I'm Director of Government Affairs and Planning for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, one of the nine federally recognized tribes. And I thank the Commission on Indian Services, and I thank years of working with the tribes that the idea that late Victor Atiyah came about with the idea to have a legislative level type of work, and I'm glad that these two senators have stepped up and taken that seriously. So again, kudos to I think the state for, there's a cultural thing going on here. It's a culture of caring, a culture of justice that for me is it's just wonderful. I've back in 1993 when I first came down here in cultural resources is that worked with I think all eight of the other tribes and state parks to come up with what we thought were the best things needed in law here to, again, push towards that justice. There's been a couple other efforts trying to, again, Oregon is a wonderful place. It's, as Senator Farioli said, it's all Indian country. Is that like Warm Springs, we have 10 million acres that we gave to the United States before there was an Oregon, and that within that 10 million acres, we have footprints and burials and camps and a lot of what's now called an archaeology resource, but it's still, as these two gentlemen have said, is a real high value to us as a people. So it's just wonderful, again, is that I appreciate the work that Oregon has done through the state legislature. Indian country. Oregon is Indian country. We have, I think, some, as Senator Farioli has brought out a number of times, the the drought really created conditions that come about with unforeseeable type of things to happen, and that's kind of the nature of your business, is what else is going to happen that we can't outguess. Well, this is something that we have seen, and there is a problem out there. And that problem is that Oregon has a real diverse cultural grouping, and some of them really don't understand their responsibility of the places where they are. And again, like in Lake County, the thousands of years, and they found, again, another cultural site in that area that's not just, 9,000 years old, but 14,000 years old as a cultural site. Wow. So we've been here a long time, and the fix here is just, again, is to try to tighten it up and to get another set of eyes, and I hope the message is getting out there that, hey, if locally you've got the heat, well, the rest of Oregon, we care very much about what makes Oregon, Oregon. And our Indian way of life, our evidence in and on the land is a part of Oregon. So again, I thank the committee and these two senators, and as well as the other members of the commission that stepped up to carry this bill and to push it on. And I only speak for Warm Springs tribes, but I think if you sent the word out to the other tribes, heck yes, they would say. And because all through I hear different stories, kind of very bad situations too. Well, they're finally learning. I used to get phone calls from the East Coast, and that's kind of the worst case scenario, where a tribal guy would call me up and say, how did you do that? We hear about you. Pretty much they're defeated, vanquished. Well, thank you. We're not, as Indian country, is not defeated. We're not vanquished. Some of us have been restored in the valley, but definitely I think with the law such as this, you help maintain the strong word, not just your good intentions, but Warm Springs is here as a matter of law, and that's through treaty. And Indian tribes are going to be getting together this month. If you can swing by there, you can learn a lot more if you have some questions about what does this treaty stuff really mean? What's this off reservation, sacred versus funerary objects and things like that? Is that and again, I think it's wonderful. Thank you, Chair and Committee, for your sensitive look towards what, for me, is a legal thing is one thing. I like to enjoy having friendships with my neighbors that, either by law or otherwise, they are caring. So this really helps, I think, us become a more caring people about what is uniquely Oregon. So thank you.
Thank you. And I can recall back in my game warden days in Sylvie Island, we would try to always keep people from digging out there, because that was a huge hunting area for many tribes would come together when the bird season was on.
Yeah, yes, sir.
And people, I would see them, sometimes somebody would have something. Yeah. And I found that, and they were grinding stones and so on. And where are they now? Maybe just in there, somebody's thrown out in their yard, or who knows.
Yeah.
Where.
Yes. Chairman, if I may. Yeah. Yes, the the history of the United States is not a good one when it comes to either human remains or just archaeology sites. And Oregon, again, had not the greatest record, and you can go to physical wars and all that, but taking care of the land, and land is so key to tribal people. So that's one of the things that we key into is the land has certain things you can see and some things you can't see. And for I think we stopped just terrible digging and laws against that probably in the late 60s. But before that time, it was fair game to dig up wherever you could in Indian country, and that I don't think that's who we really want to be.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Any Representative Springer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for bringing this bill. I like it. And I think it's the right idea. I want to talk a little bit about Section 4, and it may not be one of the three of you that are best to answer this, but I want to get the questions out there so they'll be addressed as we go through the hearing. And this is a very real problem. I know certainly Senator Ferrioli's district tons and tons of artifacts. In fact, I still have a good friend who's worked for the federal government as an archaeologist to map things out and then preserve them. So two couple concerns, one of which is basically if the district attorney says for any reason other than lack of sufficient evidence, they're not going to prosecute, then the AG's office can be brought in. The question is, what is that process? Is it most likely a tribe saying, hey, they didn't, would you? I'm curious about that process. And then the part that concerns me, and I hope it's not going to undermine this bill, and that is the part where all the costs, fees, and expenses related to the prosecution will be paid by the county. I can think of a couple counties in Senator Farioli's area. It would be easy to bankrupt a county. So what I wouldn't want to see is counties prolonging the decision, and I don't know what the statute of limitations are on these two crimes here, prolonging until we have a statute of limitation issue. So talk to me a little bit about that, and like I said, you three may not be the best three, but I see that as compromising a good intent in this bill.
Mr. Chair, if I may, and I'll try to answer the good representative's questions. First of all, arguably all the counties in my district are already bankrupt. but you ask an interesting...
I was being gracious.
Yes, you ask an interesting question about how this bill works. Really, it's a two-way street. There are circumstances where the investigation is so convoluted and the expertise in the county offices may be limited. So one of the features of the bill allows the local prosecutor to seek the assistance of the AG, not because there was a declination or a failure, but because there's consultative services available. That would be one way to trigger a partnership between the AG and the prosecutor's office. The other is if the prosecutor declines for any other reason but insufficient evidence, then that triggers a review. But what it also says is that the local district attorney can decline to prosecute if they don't have a good evidence trail, if they, in their professional decision, believe there's insufficient evidence to gain a conviction. They don't have to prosecute. They do have to report it, write it up, and say that there was a reason other than insufficient evidence, if the decision is other than on insufficient evidence, and that would trigger the potential for the AG to step in. But I believe these will be consultative services to begin with. The incentive here isn't to save the county money by kicking the prosecution upstairs to the AG's office. The prosecutor has to make a decision about whether or not there's sufficient evidence. If there is, if they don't prosecute and the AG does prosecute, they're not saving any money. They're going to pay for that prosecution, and it would be done locally in the local court. So there's no savings to be had, so the county would pay either way, whether they initiated the prosecution or the AG did. So I understand the concern, and we'll be monitoring this bill to see how often it is used. I don't expect it to be used very often. And if there's an indication that costs are not well contained or well controlled, I think we'll have to revisit that question in future legislative sessions. Mr. Chair, I do want to make another point here. This bill does not apply to anybody who makes an inadvertent discovery of archaeological artifacts. Doesn't apply to them. But it makes clear that you cannot collect something of cultural patrimony, a funerary object, or something that is clearly significant. And the bill describes that specifically by saying sacred objects, human remains, funerary objects, or objects of cultural patrimony. And I believe I could argue that a single arrowhead doesn't fit that definition. So if a kid picks up an arrowhead, it does not trigger this law. But if somebody is collecting funerary objects, objects of cultural patrimony, human remains, or sacred objects, this law does apply. So I just want to make that clear. That was part of the collaboration between prosecutors, police agencies, and tribal members. You know, we didn't want to do something ridiculous, you know, by banning the idea that an inadvertent collection of an arrowhead by a child triggers this attorney general investigation. That's not what is the object here. But if you want to see what the object of this bill is, go online. Go on to eBay. Type in the words Crump Lake Indian Artifact, and you'll be surprised at the values you'll see for artifacts that were collected and illegally removed from Oregon and now are available in the national and international market of Indian artifacts. That's what this bill's aimed at.
Yes. Thank you. Follow-up, not so much to our testifiers. I'd like to know what statute of limitations are on this to counsel.
It's a beef misdemeanor, right?
Yeah. So I think it's 2 years, isn't it?
I was guessing 2 years, but yeah. I don't want to guess.
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, that is correct.
Yes. I think a great jailhouse.
So that's a great
attorney,
question.
Mr. Chair. I know enough to be dangerous.
So, yeah, Mr. Chair, I mean, you know, since you were a Fish and Wildlife guy with state police at one time in your career, and for the senators, why didn't we elevate it up to an A misdemeanor then rather than a B?
Came from the Senate.
Oh, God. Okay, never mind.
They're more deliberate. Okay.
Yes,
this is the appropriate time for us to remain silent.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
We know it's going to go through that.
Mr. Chair, maybe Senator Cerioli and his jailhouse. If the attorney, the prosecuting attorney, refuses to, to prosecute, does the item still go back to the tribe? The item that's in question.
Mr. Chair, to Representative Greenlee's question, if the prosecutor declines to prosecute within 30 days, they have to notify the AG. The AG then takes charge of the evidence and then makes a further determination. But in any case, the intention is to determine to which tribe the artifact should be repatriated and to repatriate.
Under the law, even if the Attorney General decides not to prosecute.
I think it goes.
I think they could get it back.
Our objective is to make sure that
still
it's
go
returned.
Back. Yeah, that would be the
That's our intention.
Objective. I wonder if it's covered that way in the bill.
And if nothing else, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlink, you've given us an opportunity to put that on the record. That's the intent.
Sanchez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think you sort of brought that up here just a minute ago about, you know, how long does somebody get if they do this? How? And my concern is that knowing that there are people out there who do this eBay situation over and over and over again, and how many times is enough and how many times warrants more than a year or so in jail? And can I just, let me just follow this up and say, as a radical teenager, I thought to myself, what would it be like if I stumbled upon a pioneer graveyard or just a grave in general? What would that be like? How would that be any different? Mm-hmm. And it shouldn't be. It really just shouldn't be. So.
Mr. Chair, I do not know what the matrix would produce in terms of a sentence. I hope there's some civil liability that would follow. But in order to try to combat the demand, I think it would be appropriate for, on passage of this bill, we extract it, excerpt it, and send it to eBay and notify them that artifacts that are being sold on eBay may violate state law.
Good idea. And I would say, Representative Sanchez, a year or two ago, there was people east of Oregon that were digging up along the Oregon Trail for pioneer, and that was, the feds went after that. Was after that. So
as they should.
And I would, and the federal authorities would also go after the artifacts in Oregon. Artifacts as well. Okay. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 144A.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 144A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 144A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Sanchez, would you carry this for us, please?
I will do that.
Okay. Working public hearing on Senate Bill 14.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 14 reduces the frequency with which the Department of Corrections reviews a county's compliance with a community correction plan. Currently, the law requires that review to occur every year, and Senate Bill 14 changes it to a biennial review.
Thank you. Jeremiah Stromberg, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeremiah Stromberg, Assistant Director with the Department of Corrections, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 14. As you're well aware, the Department of Corrections is responsible to allocate the community corrections budget to the 36 counties. And along with that is the responsibility to ensure that those monies are being spent appropriately on the convicted felony supervised population within those communities. With 36 counties and the responsibility to review how those monies are spent once a year, that requires once every 10 days, our ability to go in and look at both the financials, the case management, the outcome measures of a county, and quite honestly, it is both redundant and outside our capability to be able to do so to any meaningful level. With that sort of rigorous schedule, a lot of counties are pushed off and we have been unable to meet the once a year requirement, as well as the first year, many times with a new budget, the counties are still developing and implementing their supervision and their programs. And so doing a review once during the biennium is something that's more manageable, allows us to do a more in-depth evaluation of the community corrections budget, and provide something more meaningful along the lines of technical assistance back to the counties if they need it. And so we would ask for your support in moving Senate Bill 14 forward, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 14.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 14 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 14 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Are there any objections? Mm-mm. Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Gorsuch, please, would be the carrier. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 64A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 64A renames the phrase mental disease or defect as qualifying mental disorder for purposes of Oregon criminal and juvenile delinquency law. The bill also includes a preamble expressing the intent of the Legislative Assembly to update terminology without making any substantive change to the underlying law.
Called Juliet Britton, Harris Matarazzo, and Mary Sell, please. And you can go in any order, just sure. Be sure you identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chairman Barker, Vice Chairs Olson and Williamson. I'm Juliet Britton. I'm Director of the Oregon Psychiatric Security Review Board. Senate Bill 64 is a no-fiscal bill that would rename stigmatizing statutory language, specifically those that are living with a mental illness. For almost 40 years now, individuals under our supervision and in the criminal justice system have been referred to as individuals that suffer from a mental disease or defect. Defect referring typically to a traumatic brain injury or developmental disability. The new language as proposed in this law would change that phrase to qualifying mental disorder. The phrase mental disease or defect is used in everything that we do with our board. It's in our board orders, it's in on the record when our board members communicate with patients. They're referred to as individuals with a mental defect. It's also in clinical notes and evaluations. for the individuals receiving services. This new language is in line with the DSM-5. That's the diagnostic manual that all of our clinicians and certified evaluators are using for when they assess individuals in the criminal justice system. And it has been considered the gold standard reference book. To be very clear, this bill is not going to change any sort of substantive law. That was some of the concerns of our partnering agencies, specifically Multnomah County DA had concerns about that. And so as we work through the amendments, we put in a preamble. The testimony today is that the intent is clearly just to be a renaming bill. When stigmatizing words such as defect are used to describe a particular population, they really do affect everyone living with a disability. Stigma, including self-stigma, creates a barrier for employment, having relationships, and jobs. When clients identify as somebody that has a defect, it really does affect their self-esteem and ability to become a productive member of society. So I want to note that this most recent version really is a consensus version. We worked with Disability Rights Oregon, who I believe submitted written testimony, as well as the Defense and DA's Association. And we encourage this committee to move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mary. Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I just wanted to offer really brief testimony to let the committee know that we are in support of the current version of SB 64. Truly, this is just an update to language to bring it in line with essentially more appropriate language. It's not going to change any of the underlying case law. We think that the preamble does a very good job of outlining that. And so we're just here in support. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Harris Matarazzo. I'm an attorney. I've spent much of my personal and professional career as an adult for the last 30 years working with people with mental health issues, and I'm very familiar with the PSRB system. I was opposed to this bill when it appeared before the Senate for the reasons that frankly I was concerned that the changes as proposed in the previous two versions would change Oregon law. I've litigated this issue on what is or is not a mental disease or defect for many, many years, and I'm very familiar with not only the legislative history but also the case law on the matter. I agree. I am neutral on this issue for reasons I'll get into. I agree that we do not want or need to stigmatize people with mental illnesses. That is just not acceptable. It's offensive and inappropriate. However, the attorney in me that has litigated this and litigated, frankly, against the PSRB for more than a decade of what is and is not a mental disease or defect tells me that it's really important that if this change is made, that there be nothing in the record to indicate that there was a change on the part of the legislature, that this new term takes on any additional meaning. Previous versions of this bill, frankly, did that. They tried initially to define what is and is not a mental disease or defect. Another one tried to use other kinds of language, which was inappropriate and, frankly, caused me to come before the Senate Judiciary Committee last time. And since that time, I think we've got some good or more appropriate changes here. I remain concerned, though, because in December of 2015, the board enacted an administrative rule, which, at least in my opinion and the opinion of some of the attorneys representing the state that I have litigated cases with, seeks to change the current meaning of what is a mental disease or defect. Fortunately, though, the Oregon Court of Appeals and the Oregon Supreme Court have weighed in to help clarify this in some cases. Specifically, your cases in 2004 and 2005, where the Court of Appeals and the Oregon Supreme Court determined that despite the PSRB's determination to decision otherwise, that sexual disorders and substance abuse disorders and dependency was not a mental disease or defect for purposes of keeping, first of all, using the insanity defense, and second of all, keeping people incarcerated in the state hospital as mentally ill when they clearly were not. What made the difference in those cases, because both those cases were mine, and again, it took more than a dozen years going up and down to the appellate court system to get to that decision, what made the difference was statutory construction and specifically legislative history. I was able to go to the archives and, after spending a week or so, develop enough information to convince the courts finally that your intent was not to include those kinds of individuals those kinds of diagnoses as ones capable of somebody using, capable for someone to use the insanity defense, or to be able to keep them in the state hospital if they only had those conditions. So my concern is just that the record be very, very clear. Should this be litigated again and statutory history become important, that there is no change in the meaning of the term mental disease or defect, even though the wording will be different. Thank you.
Thank you, and we'll put that in the record that this, all this does is modernize the language. It does not change the underlying piece of that. So thank you for bringing that up again. And we know the legislative history is important in those decisions. Representative Vile.
Chair Barker, I have a question about that. So are you concerned that the idea of now creating this phrase qualifying mental disorder might not capture the statements in those various appellate cases?
I think it will. It was proposed, one of the changes after our last presentation, my last appearance, was the change the term to mental disorder. And, of course, mental disorder is, as I pointed out, is a term of art used by the DSM. And if the board were to use, as it last proposed, mental disorder, that would open up the entire DSM to the insanity defense or keeping people. And that would include caffeine abuse and addiction, nicotine addiction. Those kinds of things are all included in the DSM. Many other things are as well. So the idea was not, you know, not to use that. So we used the word and
qualifying.
We used the word qualifying, and that was, I was talking to legal counsel for this state, for the Senate Judiciary Committee, and we over in a phone call kind of came up with that.
So that the way this gets framed is from now on, we say qualifying mental disorder as reflected by the case law, which determined what a qualifying disease or defect previously was.
Yes, not only case law, but exactly, not only case law, but of course statutory law as well.
But case law is what's fleshed out that statutory language.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Further questions? Mr. Chair, I have
a question.
Please. Counsel. What's the standing of beginning statement in a bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, it's a fair question. I think it doesn't have the force of statutory law. It is, if you look at the text of the bill, it is above the part that says be enacted by the people of Oregon. So it's not quite on par with the substantive law. This body sort of frequently might be a little strong, but occasionally uses preambles to and I think a court would interpret that as an expression of legislative intent that it would use to interpret the substantive law below it.
Wouldn't it be possible just to say in the bill that any reference to prior defect is covered by this change?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I do think that is possible, yes.
Wouldn't that be a stronger thing to do?
I think that would be ideal from my perspective.
Okay. Any further questions?
Over here.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not really a question to you three. I get where the bill's trying to go get us, and I want to be there. My concern is a little bit like what Representative Greenlee has spoke of. I don't want to create greater ambiguity. I don't want to increase litigation in this language. And I almost hate to admit this, but I'm kind of looking at some of our attorneys to see if you think this is going to increase or decrease. Yes, I did say that. Increase or decrease the litigation, because if this is just going to increase and create more ambiguity, then we've totally defeated the purpose here, and I'll be a no. If we haven't, I want to be a yes.
Can I follow up on that, with what you just said? Thanks, Mr. Chair. Because I do find it interesting, the letter that came from Rod Underhill's letter back on February 13th, and it was from Chuck Sparks, the deputy chief, And he actually identified what Representative Springer just kind of touched on. The new term may then become the gate through more aid and assist cases will proceed to litigation with uncertain implications for the state hospital admissions. And I realize that we moved the dash fours into, or the Senate did, but that's a question. That's a solid question.
Representative Gorsuch, did you have a question?
No.
Okay, Representative Bile.
Well, that's partly why I was asking the questions earlier. I was trying to get something on the record to make it really clear that that was our intent. I like Representative Greenlick's idea, and if there were a way to incorporate the preamble language into the bill so that it was absolutely clear that all the litigation we've had back and forth over the years on what qualifies as a mental disease or defect is the same definition as what this mental disorder would be, I think we'd be okay. But
we will do that. We won't move the bill today. We'll get an amendment that makes that crystal clear, hopefully.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Thanks.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 64A.
Thank you.
And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 338A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 338A addresses a 2015 law that regulates the sale of guaranteed asset protection waivers called gap waivers. And a gap waiver is an agreement that applies when a motor vehicle is totaled or stolen and not recovered and addresses the difference between the outstanding balance on the car and the applicable insurance coverage. The A and gross version of the bill exempts finance agreements from the scope of the law if the agreement is sold or assigned to an entity regulated under the Oregon Consumer Finance Act. There is a dash A2 amendment before you today. The amendment limits the exemption to gap waivers contained in an addendum to a finance agreement that is sold or assigned to an entity regulated under the Oregon Consumer Finance Act. Thank you.
Mr. Cosgrove.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association. That's the trade association of Oregon state-licensed consumer finance companies, many of them smaller family-owned companies, many of them have been around since the 30s. The association itself, I just looked up not too long ago, was formed in 1933. So these are older companies, been around in business and state-licensed and doing a good job. As staff has mentioned, gap waivers are a product that covers when a car has been stolen and not recovered or totaled and the balance owing is less than any applicable insurance coverage. It is not insurance, and 2 years ago, this body passed House Bill 2845 to establish a regulatory scheme for gap waivers. That's the statute that we are amending today. That regulatory scheme has a variety of aspects to it, but it explicitly says these are not insurance, they're regulated differently, and the enforcement mechanism is under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. When the bill was passed, federal chartered banks and credit unions are automatically exempt from state regulation under this gap waiver bill by federal law. And the bill recognized that in order to give parity to state chartered banks and credit unions, it was necessary to exempt them as well. The only lender who was not covered in House Bill 2845 was Oregon's state-licensed consumer finance companies. So what this bill does is addresses that to level the playing field for those companies who are competing with banks and credit unions to finance car purchases. The amendment that you have before you, first of all, the Senate amended the bill to make it a little bit narrower, which was fine, and we supported that amendment. And the amendment you have before you today makes it even a little bit narrower than that. So, for example, if a gap waiver is sold by a consumer finance company on one of its loans on a car to purchase a car, it's still covered by your gap waiver statutes. And if a retail installment contract is written at a car dealership and then assigned to a consumer finance company, the gap waiver law applies to the dealership. It just doesn't apply to the consumer finance company. There are plenty of other restrictions and requirements on the consumer finance company that make it sensible to have this kind of an exemption, and also as a matter of competitive advantage, it makes sensible to have this lender treated the same way with respect to deals it buys from car dealers as banks and credit unions. So with that, I'd urge your adoption of the dash A2 amendment and passage of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Will you say one more time what a GAP waiver is?
Sure. GAP stands for, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, GAP stands for Guaranteed Asset Protection. So it is a guarantee by an entity that the lender who is owed a loan for secured by a car, if that car is stolen and not recovered, and or if the car is totaled, and the amount of the insurance coverage either on the theft or on the totaling is less than what's owed on the loan is paid under the GAP waiver. It's a benefit to the lender. It's also a benefit to the consumer. There's no deficiency left over. It covers any difference that's not covered by insurance.
Who is that paid by?
The GAP waiver entity, a company that issues the GAP waiver. And those companies are not regulated as insurance companies, but they're regulated under the statute you passed 2 years ago, House Bill 2845, the GAP waiver bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just thought, I've purchased so many new vehicles in my life. At least the first 27, I did not buy GAP because I thought it was something the car salesman was just trying to get me. So to Representative Greenlee, it's great. It came into play for me one time. So GAP insurance is fantastic. GAP waiver, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Post. I think the concern and the reason this business has grown is if you have zero interest loans with very small down payments and cars depreciate relatively rapidly, you can have cases where the loans are worth more than the car at any given time. So
they don't depreciate until you drive off the lot.
Yeah,
that is correct. And then, maybe when you sign the papers, they start depreciating, but they depreciate pretty fast.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, close the public hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill 338. We have a -2 amendment on the table.
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendments into Senate Bill 338A.
Representative Williamson moves the -2 amendments into Senate Bill 338A. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 338A as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 338A. As amended to the floor, the due pass recommendation. Again, are there any discussions? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Post, would you carry that for us? Sure. Story?
Can I spend time explaining GAP insurance?
No.
Apparently not.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 899A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 899A creates the Oregon Receivership Code. And it applies to the majority of receivership proceedings initiated in Oregon courts. The bill describes the powers, duties, and obligations of the receiver and the property owner and establishes a host of procedures related to the exercise of receivership. Thank you.
Mark Comstock and Andrea, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Mark Comstock. I'm a practicing lawyer. I'm also a member of the Oregon Law Commission, and I come here to with the reporter for our work group, Professor Andrea Cole-Bierre, to urge your support and a due pass recommendation for the Senate Bill 899A, which defines receivership and how a receivership operates. Prior to this bill, receiverships in the state of Oregon were governed by Oregon Rule of Civil Procedure 80 and 82, and I can tell you that it is very sparse in what instruction it gives to courts about receiverships. This bill came out of really a question to me, and I've seen it from several other lawyers who practice in this area. A judge will say, well, counsel, where do I have the statutory authority to do what you ask? And what this bill does is codifies really the same grounds for appointment of a receiver, but fills in all of the various gaps about how a receivership should operate. It does not attempt to change the relative balance of power between creditors and debtors, but it does fill in the gaps. The bill also does specifically make it so a state agency may opt in to have this bill govern receiverships, but it does not require a state agency to do so. An example, recent example, an insurance company was placed into receivership by the insurance division of Department of Consumer and Business Services. Department of Consumer and Business Services, and especially the insurance division, has a very detailed procedure for a receivership in an insurance situation. That is certainly adequate to govern receiverships where we don't have the same specificity for the operation of a receivership in a non-insurance situation. So it allows the agency to opt in or not. And this bill would govern commercial situations. An example would be an apartment company or apartment complex that is security for a loan. Common situation. Well, right now, the only thing that governs that is rather antiquated case law going back to the mid-1800s. I think the most recent case is 1985. A lot has changed in that time frame, and this is a way to have specificity about how this operates. So I would certainly welcome any questions you might have, and Professor Colbert can get right down into the weeds of all those. So I'd ask for support and a do pass. Thank you.
Chair Barker, vice chairs, and members of the committee, my name is Andrea Colbert. I'm an associate professor of bankruptcy law at the University of Oregon School of Law and faculty director of the business law program. I was appointed by the Oregon Law Commission to serve and have served as the reporter for this receivership bill. With the committee schedule and the length of this bill, I could just highlight certain important sections of the bill, but of course I'd be happy to do a section by section summary if the committee would prefer.
Highlights are probably okay, I would think.
Highlights are good. Okay, great. Well, the menu of powers that Mr. Comstock mentioned is in Section 11, the powers of the receiver. This section, more than any other, provides direction to the court, makes explicit the basis of authority, and somewhat broadens the provisions of ORCP 80D by setting forth the menu of powers from which a court may choose to confer upon a receiver. And it includes things like collecting and controlling and managing estate property, engaging and compensating professionals, making improvements to estate property, using or transferring estate property outside of the ordinary course of business, a power that's more fully set forth in another section that I can highlight for you, assuming or rejecting, that is, performing or breaching executory contracts, another section of the bill that I could summarize for you, and allowing and or disallowing claims. This menu of options is the handy reference that attorneys appearing before state court judges can point to when seeking a receivership order at the commencement of a receivership. I'll mention just by way of background that in putting together this bill, The committee considered various precedents. One was a Uniform Act promulgated by the Uniform Laws Commission, which governed specifically the receivership of real property. We wanted a more comprehensive act. We borrowed certain concepts from this Uniform Act, but it was not as comprehensive as we wanted because receiverships cover things, more things than just real property. We also considered the existing Washington Receivership Act, a more comprehensive statute than we had, but also not quite exactly what we wanted in certain areas. And then we work from our own small number of procedural statutes in the ORCP. We had the choice to adopt the Uniform Act in whole, adopt the Washington Act in whole, or to create Oregon's own form of law. And we took the last and more difficult route of creating our own statute, taking the best of the existing precedents and putting them in what we think is the best form of law that would operate for our state.
I have a question, Mr.
Chair. Great question, please.
Section 11, the power of the receivers, L, small, N, pay compensation to the receiver. Is that a norm?
Is it a norm that receivers get compensated?
That they have the power to pay themselves?
Mm-hmm. They do, pursuant to court order.
Okay.
Hey, Representative Vile.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. This is long needed, as Mr. Comstock will tell us for sure, and I'm really glad that we've got it. The only thing I'm wondering about is we've still got the statement, receivership is the process by which a court appoints a person. Did we not think about the ability to allow entity receiverships?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vile, yes, we did consider the entity being a receiver, and if you look in Section 3 in the definitions, sub 13, and we've defined person to mean individual, corporation, limited liability company, general partnership, limited liability partnership, cooperative business trust, government entity, or other entity of any kind or nature.
Thank you. That does the trick. And tell me, if you would, what Section 43A2 is doing. I think that's page 20, line 28. Let's look down there at that.
Chair Barker, Representative Vile, Section A2 of Section 43 is designed to specifically identify what the hierarchy is of which law controls, and it provides that this receivership code, assuming it's adopted, would govern over conflicting provisions with respect to receiverships. So, for example, if someone wanted to argue that ORCP 80 should control in a specific thing, after the effective date of this act, assuming it's adopted, it would be the receivership code that controls, not ORCP 80.
Okay. Being ORCP 80 is the only thing we've really got right now with respect to receiverships. Well, Mr. Chairman, I can tell you this is a very important issue for the literally tens of thousands of homeowner associations that we have in Oregon now, who often are unable to collect assessments, and because of banks not being willing to do foreclosures, need to be able to take possession of a property, rent it out, and use that as the ability to get assessments, to pay common assessments. So I'm particularly excited about the benefits that this brings us.
Who becomes the receiver in that case?
Well, that's why I checked on the entity, Representative Greenlick, that the best thing is for the Homeowners Association entity itself to become the receiver. That way there's not added fees on the owner at that point. The entity just does the collection of the rents and pays its common assessment, holds the rest of the money for the owner that has been in default.
Okay, any further questions? Okay, thank you very much. Open up session on Senate Bill 899A.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 899A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 899A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Vile, would you carry that for us?
Happy to. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could I make a motion that we suspend the rules and allow Representative Stark to vote on Senate Bill 14 and Senate Bill 144?
And Vile needs the same. Vile needs the same. Right? Wasn't he out for those?
Yeah, I missed 14 also.
Okay, we'll suspend the rule.
I've been keeping a chart. That's the only reason.
You know, I rescind my motion.
We'll suspend the rules and allow Representative Vile. Representative Vile, how do you vote on the, and which bill was it?
14.
14. You, how do you vote?
Yes.
Okay. Aye. And Representative Stark on 14 and 144, please.
Aye, matey.
Okay.
Actually, Vile needs 144A as well.
And you need 144A.
Aye.
Okay. Thank you.
Aye.
Thank you, committee. Stand adjourned. Thank you, committee. Stand adjourned.